My guest in the studio tonight has worked with musicians from every continent of the globe. He can truly be called a world music pioneer in this country. He's lived and studied and performed in the Balkans, West Africa, Turkey, and throughout Asia, amongst many other places. He co-led Australia's first world jazz band, Rabadaki, in 1979, and maintains his band Kim Sanders and Friends, both in Australia and in Turkey. He plays in excess of 14 wind instruments and is about to launch the third album of that band, entitled Bent Grooves. Kim Sanders, welcome.
Thank you.
Kim, I wanted to start by, I was reading your website this afternoon, and you were once a cane cutter and even an abattoir labourer, two professions that are pretty remote from music itself. Were you always attracted to music?
Yes, I was, but at that time of my life, I was studying philosophy at university, and I thought I'd see a bit of the world, so I ran away from home and went up to Queensland, worked in the meatworks and cut cane, and after I'd done that for a while, I figured out that studying wasn't all that tough after all, really. So I went back the following year and ended up getting a degree, but then I goofed off again and drifted into music.
Where did you grow up? Where were you born? And tell us about your background.
I was born in Avalon, which in those days, I was born in 1948, in those days had three shops and had a dirt road. It was a fantastic place to grow up. You know, we lived 100 yards from the beach, and looking back on it now, at the time I thought it was just normal, but now I realise it was just paradise. You could go and run around in the bush, and as long as you were home by 5 o'clock for dinner, you go, half an hour after, or 10 minutes after school finished, you could be in a surf, and it's wonderful. But my family were interested in, my mother and father were interested in music, and they were pretty open-minded. Classical music was their scene, but they were pretty open-minded, and so whatever kinds of music I got into along the way, they were happy about that.
You've worked in probably as diverse array of cultures as one could think. For example, the Zimbabwean mbira player Stella Chiwese, performing in Beijing as a soloist and with the pioneering Chinese world jazz ensemble Qian Chang. Tell us about your philosophy as a musician.
Well, what could I say in one sentence? Duke Ellington said that there's only two kinds of music, good music and bad music, and I think that's pretty close to the mark. I started off my professional music career playing in R&B bands, playing tenor sax in R&B bands, but I'd been interested in folk music and Bob Dylan and all kinds of things, and I gradually discovered other kinds of music in the late 60s, and in part through jazz. People like Don Cherry and John Coltrane sort of getting into some other kinds of non-Western musics. But I've recently, or about a year ago, discovered the first world music record that I ever got, which was in 1962, I think. There was a novelty record. It sounds very condescending now, but at the time that was what it was called. Novelty record that got about to number 37 on the top 40 by the Bechuanaland Boys from South Africa. It was a 45, and I heard it on the radio, and I thought it was fantastic. It was a Kwela Township tin whistle and guitar sort of thing. Both sides, great, and I rediscovered it. So now we're actually doing one of the tunes off that record called Digawe. We're doing that in the band now. We'll be doing it on Thursday night, just slipping a little bit of 60s township music into the mix.
Jazz and more regional musics have always seemed to sit quite comfortably together. The term world jazz or world music, or it's been around for a while, hasn't it? I mean, Dizzy Gillespie first started exploring it. It's not something new, but it seems to be gathering in popularity again.
In this day and age, it's for those of us who live in the West and can afford to buy CDs and listen to radio programs, it's madness not to enjoy the best music from all around the world. We have access to those things now. 30 years ago, people didn't. You had to look very hard to find a record from Africa or India or somewhere.
Had to travel very widely.
You had to travel now. But now you have access to that level very easily. And of course, if you're serious about it and you're a musician, you have to go to the place and respect and all that. But also, you can't really understand the music in the abstract just by sort of writing down the notes or recording the notes. And parroting them off. You have to understand the role of music in society, whether it's, you know, music for, used for religious purposes or for, you know, for dancing or to play at weddings or whatever it's for. And you have, so you have to understand the culture, and that also means understanding the language.
And of course, you have travelled widely and lived extensively overseas in various cultures. How easily is it for you to pick up a different regional music when you go to somewhere new?
A series of experiences, has been playing with Romani or Gypsy musicians in the Balkans and Turkey, and they're people in some ways similar to Aboriginal people in Australia, that people say they're all thieves and layabouts and wastrels and blah blah blah, and they live on the outskirts of town, and you know, their kids don't go to school, and you know, because they get beaten up when they go to school. And in fact, when you dig a little more deeply, you find that there's perfectly good reasons for what they do. But they are the best musicians around in a lot of those places. You know, if you're having a wedding, you get a Romani band, you know. And the musicians I've met, Romani musicians, after the initial period of suspicion, which you can understand, fantastic people, and they understood what I was about, which was, you know, I'm a person, from as far as they're concerned, you know, a hugely wealthy person. I've probably got a huge house and a Ferrari and a swimming pool, and that kind of, which is not exactly true, but, you know, from their perspective, they no doubt think that, at least when they first meet me. But after a while, I got to play with them, and the barriers broke down. And they could understand perfectly well why I would be in that position, in a position to have access to all those material goods. But I would choose not to do that. Instead of having a house, I go to Africa and wander around and sleep on the floor in Bulgaria or whatever, and play music. You know? Whereas other people mostly would find that very hard to get their heads around. You know?
So. Your form of communication when you go to various cultures like this is through your music. How easy is it to pick up the dialect when you go to a place like Gambia?
Well, Gambia is easier than Senegal because it was an English colony, so most people speak English there. You know. Senegal, I had a bit more. Well, I was playing with a band called the Liberal Jazz Band, who I stumbled across in a small town in the middle of Gambia, and they were passing through and doing a gig there. And we met up, and the only common language we had was because my Wolof wasn't all that good at that time. Well, it still isn't, to tell the truth. But the common language was French, which I learned at school, you know. But I can tell you, the French they spoke was not exactly what I had in my textbook at school. You know? It was sort of like the equivalent of Jamaican English. And if so we struggled through, you know. I was under a slight misapprehension because I thought they said, come and join the band. I thought, oh, great, this will be, because I had my soprano sax with me, and they said, come and join the band, and it's a good band. And I thought they said that it had a big horn section. So I said, oh, beauty, here's where I learned some stuff and play with the horn section. And but I found out that I was actually the horn section. And it was about a 9 or 10 piece band. You know, there were sort of three singers and but guitars and several, you know, kinds of drums, including talking drum tama. So it was a great experience playing with them, but the communication was a little bit difficult sometimes. But in other places, I just learned to speak the language, you know. I can speak passable Turkish now and Bulgarian, although Bulgarian's a little bit rusty, because in Macedonian, a smattering of Greek, Indonesian's not too bad. So you just have to because musicians generally don't speak English in all of those places. Some places they do, you know. Mm. But certainly in the places that I've been to and the music that I've been interested in, the musicians tend not to speak English. So you've got to learn their language if you want to find out the stuff.
Kim, you were playing the tenor saxophone there. Sandy Evans was playing the soprano saxophone, Steve Elphick the bass, and Bobby Singh playing the tabla. A fine quartet, that one. You could almost take that one out on the road as well.
Yes, well, I wouldn't mind. It's just a matter of getting them all in one place at one time is the problem.
Pretty busy players, aren't they?
Yeah.
The soprano saxophone there of Sandy Evans seems to suit that style piece.
Yes, well, it sort of started out to be a Balkan gypsy thrash sort of tune in 13/8, but it sort of when I thought about the improvising, it seemed to just drift into that sort of two-chord Congolese sukus sort of thing. I mean, the rhythm's different, but just the way those, you know, the way the guitars weave in and out of each other in that sukus music, and so that's what we were trying to do with the saxophone. So it's a form of collective improvisation, which is another thing that I'm really interested in.
You tend to gravitate back to Turkey. Indeed, you spent years in the country studying and performing. What is it specifically about Turkey and its music that you love?
It's a really rich musical culture. That's what I like about it. You go to a party in Turkey and someone will pull down a saz and start playing it, and they can play, you know, there's no sort of strumming Gloria with three chords or something, and they could all play and they can all sing in tune and with the quarter tones, and everyone knows 100 folk songs, you know. And they can clap in 9/8, and they appreciate musicians, you know, which is a bit of a change from Australia sometimes, you know. So I love Turkey, you know, and also because the diversity of the musical cultures. I mean, there's just so many different kinds of music in Turkey. There's Central Anatolian kind of music, and on the west coast it's different, and in Thrace up near Greece and Bulgaria and the peninsula there, it's different rhythms and different style of playing. The Far East, Erzurum, is a place that I really like, and I do a few tunes from Erzurum because they're just some really beautiful tunes. The North Coast, there's the Laz people, who are fair-haired people who speak a different language, and the music is a bit different from the other kinds of Turkish music. When I was in Istanbul recently, I was working with a Laz musician called Birol Topalolu, and we did a few gigs together, and I played with him the previous trip 7 years before. So it's, you know, there's just such a... And, of course, again, the Romani music. I studied with a guy called Selim Sesler, who is from the Thracian region of Turkey, and he was called by the Coltrane of the clarinet in Turkey, which is... Not altogether true, because he wasn't a revolutionary like Coltrane, but he's certainly a master of what he does. It's just fantastic. You know, he's got it down, and the improvisation between him and his groups, you know, especially the percussionists, you know, and they've been playing together. And a lot of them are his sons and his nephews, and so they know each other's playing backwards, and just the way they just shift from one thing to another, you know, change of key, you know, drop it down a tone, whatever, is lovely.
When you go to these various cultures, do you go with a specific instrument in mind that you intend to play, or do you tend to cart the tenor saxophone and all the other instruments around with you, just in case that you do sort of hit a modern jazz scene, for example, in Istanbul? And
well, there is a modern jazz scene in Istanbul, but I don't usually go there terribly much. Because it's like in any other Western. I mean, Turkey and Istanbul in particular is a huge contrast between thoroughly Europeanized. It could be in any big European city, mm-hmm. and totally, you know, Eastern. And so the jazz scene. I mean, it's a good scene, and there's good musicians there, and stuff they play is great. But it's not so different from what we can find here. You know? Mm-hmm. So I tend to go for the things that aren't available here.
You obviously have a great love of jazz. And the greats of jazz, the musicians.
Certainly.
You choose people like Sandy Evans and Steve Elphick in your lineup. Given their background, what in particular are you looking for them to bring to the table of your music?
Open-mindedness, first of all. It's not all jazz musicians who are open-minded. Some of them think that they've got the chops and blah, 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 and they say this tune's in 9/8, they go, oh, yeah, 9/8. And they think they can play it, but there's 9/8 and there's 9/8, you know. So they have to be humble enough and open-minded enough to say, okay, well, now, you know, I'm not an expert in this field. Tell me about it, you know.
Yeah.
And then they can use their chops and their musical intelligence and their ear and their talent to do something different. So that's why it's great working with people like Sandy and Steve and Bobby Singh, coming from a different tradition, and Lou Keek and George Dukas and Bobby Dmitrievsky and Carlos Villanueva. They're all coming from different places, but they're all more or less intersection with jazz.
Yes.
And so it's, you know, drawing on from all those things you can draw on and make something new and exciting, which is what jazz is about. You know, it's about making the those wonderful times when something incredible happens, you know.
Yeah, connections between cultures and also connections between personalities and characters.
Yeah, sure. And there can be connections with cultures, and there can also, you know, a lot of sort of fusion music, and a lot of world music is very shallow, pastiche sort of things, you know, and it's sort of lowest common denominator music. And I hate that. But when you've got people who respect each other's cultures enough to find out a little bit about it, then you can start to do something. And then that's when the magic starts, after you've been playing together for long enough to get to know each other's musical personalities and how you play and a bit about the other kind of music. That's when the magic can start to happen.
Kim, this is the third album for this band, is that correct?
No, it's the second album from Kim Sanders and Friends. In between there was one I did with percussionist Peter Kennard called Trance and Dancing, and that had a lot of Turkish grooves and different kinds of things, but that was more of a studio album with overdubs and more of a trance thing, just trying to get the feels circulating around, you know, whereas this is more of a sort of spontaneous improvisation thing.
Tell us about this piece by Bash Taksim.
This is in Sufi music and Turkish classical music. There's a big overlap between those things. They do a thing which is like the alap in Indian music, which might be more familiar to some jazz musicians, because jazz musicians have been playing Indian music for longer, which is like an introduction to the rag in Indian music, or the makam in Turkish music. Introduces the makam and just gradually unfolds the characteristics and the characteristic phrases and so on of the makam. And then the rhythm comes in, and then you start playing the pieces. So this is like the introduction. It's played on the ney, which is the Turkish cane flute that's used for Sufi rituals by the whirling dervishes, amongst other kinds of dervishes. The hardest instrument that I've ever played. That's mostly what I was studying when I was over there for 3 months recently. Extremely hard, because it's the technical problems of the instrument and the music itself is fearsomely difficult. You know, you need 53 notes to the octave to be able to play all the makams, you know, and you only have 6 holes on the flute. So, you know,
that's the ney.
Anyway.
Can you describe the physicality of that?
It's made of a kind of cane that you find down near, in Turkey, down near the Syrian border, but throughout there's an Arabic version of the same thing. But the Turkish version has a little mouthpiece thing which looks like a little Christmas tree on the end that you rest your lip against, called the bashpari, which means the little thing on the end. Fiendishly difficult to make and fiendishly difficult to play, but the music is just stunning. And I went back there, and I wish I was 20 years old so I could... I'd have a chance of becoming a real grandmaster.
Steve Elphick there with a drone on the double bass, just playing the bow. Is that right?
Yes, mostly droning. Well, he did do a few other things towards the end.
Hmm. And that was a freeform piece.
Well, freeform within the rules of the makam.
2/3 of the way through that, he went up quite a few notes. Were you aware that he was going to do that, or?
Yes, because that's that note that he went up to is the it's called the güçlü, which means the strong note. It's like the dominant in Western music. It's the next most important one to the tonic note.
Right.
And so a lot of the time with that makam, you hang around. It's like a false tonic. You hang around and improvise around that note. Then at the very end, you come back again to the first one. You know? That's the nature of that makam.
And the difficulty in the ney, playing the ney, is it the difficulty in actually getting the sound or achieving the correct notes?
Both. I can remember when I first picked up an ney, and it took me about 2 hours before I got a squeak out of it. and this is a common experience. Flute players, you know, people who play in symphony orchestras pick up an ney, and they, half an hour later, they still haven't heard any sound yet.
But, is there any one particular player you think, you know, given your diversity in music, that you could point to as a major influence?
There isn't one. There's so many. In the jazz world, I think Archie Shepp is a big influence on me. Plus the usual saxophone players, you know, Coltrane and Charlie Parker and Sonny Rollins, etc. Hmm. But Archie Shepp was a big influence on me. And I met him in Istanbul, actually, in 90, was it 93? Was it? Yeah, I think 93. Well, no, 2000. He was doing a gig there, and it was fantastic, and old ballads, and beautiful, you know.
When I hear the name Archie Shepherd, certainly reaching for something greater than what he may have even been capable of doing. Someone that's, always stretching his limits.
Yeah, well, when I first heard him, it was sort of in the 60s, and he was playing a lot of wild and crazy stuff then. But I just loved his sound, and he did. His ballads were got me particularly. He did it. There's a record called New Thing at Newport. One of those impulse, because he plays one side and Coltrane's on the other side. Coltrane's not particularly good, in fact. But Archie Shepherd was playing with Bobby Hutcherson. There's a couple of tunes on that are just hair-raising. Really, just make the hair in the back of your neck stand up. But as far as non-jazz musicians, there's a guy called Camille Gould who, this is a long story, and we need about a four-hour program to tell this story, but he was an old guy who I eventually tracked down in a village in Western Turkey and studied with, and he was the wildest and craziest guy to play, which is the bagpipe. And so I dedicated the previous album to him. And he was, I play an instrument now I call the aardvark, which is a kind of Turkish-Bulgarian hybrid Australian bass bagpipe.
And you've created that, haven't you?
I've asked a few instruments. I wouldn't say I created it. I ran a few ideas past some instrument maker friends of mine, and they all made various contributions, and so it's really their thing. I just asked the questions and said, "How about it?" You wait around for several years, and eventually you get what you've asked for.
Do you know of anyone else that plays that as well?
No. There's only one in the world, and that's it.
Is that the instrument that, to me, it looks like you're holding a koala bear and then playing?
Yeah, it's actually a goatskin.
Goatskin, is it?
Yeah. Well, the aardvark is bagpipes are a difficult thing as far as reeds go, and even more orthodox kinds of bagpipes. Although there are bagpipes all over the world, and in China and India and all over Europe, different kinds, and certainly in the Balkans. And the aardvark, it does look a little bit like an aardvark, it's got a long snout and it's all hairy and horrible looking, but it's actually called an aardvark because when your reeds go feral in the middle of a gig and make terrible noises and go out of tune and make you look like a real goose, that's what you usually exclaim, aardvark. This makes you feel better.
That's a totally different breathing method to playing the saxophone. Do you find that actually assists with your chops when it comes to picking up the tenor?
With the bagpipes, not so much, because the breathing is not such a problem with those, because assuming that your reeds are working properly and your bag's not leaking, if your bag's leaking, you're in trouble. But all you have to do is just blow into the bag. There's no great breath control needed. The breath control is done by the pressure on the bag with your arm. That's right. That's the control.
Okay.
But certainly with the ney and the kabal, which is another kind of wooden edge blown flute, the breath control there is certainly helpful when you're playing tenor, and also awareness of the overtones, because like I say, you've only got six holes on a ney and a thumb hole on the back, so you've got to get 2.5 or nearly 3 octaves of range and 53 notes of the octave out of that. So the breath control is really important, and the knowledge of the overtones and the mix of the overtones in the sound and all that kind of stuff. And after you've been studying that with ney, you find that when you go back to saxophone, you're more familiar with thinking in that way about it.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about Bad Bodgy Bulerius? Is that correct?
Bulerius. Bulerius as well. Well, a few years ago, I did I did some gigs with Aboriginal flamenco world fusion group, and so that's where I learned to about the Bulerius, which is a flamenco dance rhythm in 12/8. It started off being a Bulerius, but we changed it a little bit, so it's not strictly kosher on the Bulerius front now. But and I thought it'd be really nice to ask Carlos Villanueva to come in and play some charango on it, and which he did, and it turned out to be very good. I like this one a lot.
Thanks very much, Kim. My Kim pleasure, Sanders.